news from the red planet, and how to track gravity waves. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. From exploring formation in the ridges of the red planet to using a new navigation system, NASA's Martian rovers are keeping busy. So just what have Perseverance and Curiosity been up to? We'll speak with University of Florida's Amy Williams about the two Martian rovers. Then, terrestrial weather and space weather can impact our satellites. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Matthew Zettergren is studying gravity waves and how to better protect satellites from interference. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Curiosity and Perseverance have been busy exploring Mars, observing rocks, ridges, and even looking for signs of life or water. Curiosity is busy studying boxwork formations, or geological phenomenon often made from groundwater, and Perseverance has been using new techniques to navigate Mars. Here to tell us about all the latest findings from Mars is Amy Williams. She's an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a member of the rover's science teams. Amy, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Oh, thanks for having me back on the show.
There's always something fun to talk about on Mars. I'm so glad you're here. Curiosity, we're going to start with that bugger. It's exploring an area on Mars with these large boxwork formations that they kind of look like spider webs from above. What are we looking at?
As a geologist, this is clearly a boxwork. But if you look at it from orbit, yes, you can pretend that you've seen a spider make a web that looks kind of rectangular. I'm not being judgy here, I promise. These features are these big geologic scale structures in the bedrock. And we've talked about them before on the show, but it's one of the things that has been referred to, you know, sort of in like the media and like kind of describing what these structures might look like as spider webs. Something that we saw from orbit before we ever even, you know, as part of the decision to go to Gale Craters, the hope that one day we could climb up the mountain and get to see these in person or in rover, I guess. And so, yeah, we finally arrived at the boxwork, which is also being described as spider webs.
Okay, we're going to use boxwork for the rest of this conversation because I don't want to get yelled at by you. So why are these boxworks so interesting? I've got to imagine it's because of how they're formed.
Oh, always, right? So our quick geology lesson here. So we are way up the mountain at this point. And these features are really cool because like so many things I get excited about on Mars, they're made by water. This tells us that there was water, like the water that would have made this, it wasn't necessarily flowing on the surface. This is more so groundwater. Groundwater is that which like moves through cracks in the rocks, moves through pore space in the rock. And these features are super cool because like they formed inside of the mountain and they have since been eroded away and exposed that we're able to explore them with the rover today. And so the way that we think boxworks form on, you know, all over the place, but also, you know, specifically on Mars is that water was flowing through these cracks and probably built up sort of a cemented or resistant region, which is the ridges in this boxwork. And the areas that didn't have that cement are probably the hollows. And so those are the, you know, the kind of the two terms for the terrain we're exploring. And I encourage your viewers, if you have an opportunity to look these up, take a gander at them. I mean, it's really gorgeous. It's on the you know, scale of meters for each one of these hollow ridge sets. It's really gorgeous.
Let me see if I'm wrapping my head around this correctly. Is it that there was water once flowing underground that has created these phenomena, or is it the fact that water flowed near them and eroded the rock away, and now we can see them?
Oh, excellent question. So they formed by water flowing as groundwater in the subsurface. Don't think of it as like a river flowing underground, but just water moving sort of between the pores, between grains in the rock. So this is a slow, generally slow moving kind of process. So that's how they formed. And then probably it was aeolian erosion, so wind-based erosion that removed the cover of this, and it probably removed a ton of rock for us to be able to explore this on Mars today. But, you know, if you have billions of years of the wind blowing, that's a good way to, you know, over time, remove a good chunk of material.
Did you use the term aeolian?
Yes. So that is the my professional term, but it means wind.
It sounds like something you'd put on a sandwich or a burger.
Right. Oh, I just went some garlic aeolian. And I can't explain my beef with the spider web thing, which is that there are these really cool features that folks should look up that were dubbed spider webs. And it's basically a seasonal sort of degassing of CO2, I think, in the southern hemisphere. And so you get these really cool little ephemeral features that form that people also kind of call spider webs. So check them out at some point. Maybe we can talk about them later. But that's the only place where my beef comes from with the terminology. But either way, they're both really cool features on Mars.
Okay. So spider webs are cool in their own right. Boxworks are cool as well. And I guess finally, on the last bit of talking about Boxworks is now that Curiosity is there and is imaging it, what are you able to take away from what you found?
So we're still actively exploring this region, trying to figure out if our models for how groundwater could have formed this environment are they accurate? You know, we're straight up hypothesis testing on Mars in real time, which is always a real cool thing to step back and recognize as a scientist that we're able to do. So we're trying to make sure that these are made the way that we thought that they formed. We are also getting this opportunity to look into this is basically an aquifer. And so getting to look into a subsurface environment where there was water in the ancient past, perhaps the other components that we know life as we know it needs to survive could have been present. And so are we looking at a habitable environment from the ancient past? You know, we know that there's life in the subsurface of Earth today. Over geologic time, there has been. And so is it possible there could have been life, you know, in these environments supported by this habitable a subsurface aquifer system? So some of those questions we can't address with Curiosity, but it certainly is some of that strong motivation behind exploring what, you know, it's just such an incredible landscape.
It always comes back to water and life. You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Amy Williams, an astrobiologist from the University of Florida and also a member of the rover's science teams. We're going to switch rovers. Perseverance finally has a kind of a GPS system. I led to ask, how the heck was it getting around Mars in the first place?
So much of what we do is getting images down from our deep space network that the rover has relayed and looking at our orbital images and knowing where we said we wanted to go and then comparing what's in basically our engineering camera images to where we think we're supposed to be, and then we can localize in that way. Although this is something that, you know, we still do and kind of ground truth, what we're doing now is getting the opportunity to, give this system sort of its own GPS in a way where it can compare what it's seeing with where it expects to go and what the terrain looks like with orbital images and actually kind of figure it out for itself. And it's gotten really good. I think, you know, you can get down to within like 10 centimeters accuracy, which is crazy. Like I can barely park my car between the lines. So like I'm really impressed by this.
So it's essentially navigating by Google Street View and satellite view.
Yeah. That's right. It's like if you have satellite view and you're looking around, you're like, all right, I see that big tree on the satellite view, but of course, no trees on Mars. So how about I see that big rock? I think this is roughly where I am. And actually, it's really improved our ability to navigate, kind of figure out where we are.
And I'm sure that database that feeds into that is just getting bigger and bigger with the more and more photographs you take for the next rovers, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, to be able to tell a vehicle, like, I want to go over here. Can you, you know, auto nav? Can you drive yourself? And for it to be able to figure out where it is, know that it's avoiding, you know, hazards, big rocks, stuff like that, sand dunes that we don't want to go through. And for it to be able to do that without necessarily requiring what we call ground in the loop, we are the ground, that makes a big difference in how much you can explore, how quickly.
And it lays the groundwork for something that Perseverance wants to do, right? And that's AI planned drives. Tell us a bit about your hope with what's coming next for Perseverance's navigation.
Yeah, so we've been testing out, and this is the you know, magicians truly at JPL have been testing out the ability to use a version of AI to have it look at the terrain, look at the orbital images, you know, we tell it where we want to go or what our overall objective is. And it actually picked the right waypoints to tell the rover where to go. And that's pretty incredible because, you know, right now it's people, it's, you know, my friends at JPL, we say, hey, we want to go over here, but can you bop over to this rock first and then find the safest way to get to, you know, rock B, C, or D. And AI actually figured out how to do it, you know, pretty well. I have mixed feelings just because, like, it's so cool that you're being able to automate this kind of thing so that perhaps you can explore so much more without requiring ground in the loop. A little bit sad is that it's really fun to look at the images and say, you know, I think that these are going to be the targets that are going to be so cool to go check out. So then you ask our rover planners to sketch out what the mobility looks like, and we go from there. So it's an incredible capability. And I think that, you know, sort of that marriage of robotic AI and humans is hopefully the best path forward, where we're all getting a little bit of the piece of the science and the exploration.
What is the hope for this, Amy, that paths can be kind of plotted faster or more safely? Is what's the end goal for bringing AI into the loop?
Part of what you can do is, you know, deciding and executing like the safest path. It does allow you to kind of reduce, you know, if you need to reduce the number of personnel who are like on shift over a month, potentially that gives you an opportunity to have the AI deal with some of that and then still have humans ground in the loop when necessary. But I think, you know, where we're really moving to is if we want to do kilometers worth of exploration, not just moving in the order of tens to hundreds of meters, you're probably looking at generative AI that can help make those decisions, stay within, you know, the safety nets of don't drive off a cliff, but we don't really normally drive too close to cliffs. But being able to basically accomplish a lot more mobility and then in that case, science, without necessarily needing humans to make every single call.
Will we ever get to a point where humans are out of that loop, Amy?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. You know, when AI came online, I think it did an interview several years ago now, and I was like, I don't know, you know, I feel like you always need, like, I'm so reliant on that human component. But I think what I said was like, you know, if every AI movie I've ever seen was right, then I'm going to be wrong and it will be able to do it on its own.
It's still getting the scientists to pick out where to go, though, right?
That would be my hope, right? That like our eye for something that's curious may still be able to kind of drive that science. There's always going to be, you know, exciting, unexpected things that we can pivot to. But there is a lot of systematic stuff that I think AI is demonstrating is actually pretty good at.
Well, until that day comes when AI takes everything over, we will still lean on you to tell us what is going on the Red Planet. Amy Williams is an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a member of the Rover's science teams. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, understanding gravity waves.
I think of them as buoyancy waves. So if you have a medium like the Earth's atmosphere, which is sort of stratified into layers, then they have different pressure levels. If you take a volume of air and move it down or up, it has a tendency to oscillate back and forth. Gravity wants to pull it down and the buoyancy wants to support it.
Gravity waves and how terrestrial and space weather collide. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. As we get closer and closer to sending humans back to the moon for good, we have to ask ourselves, if people are going to stay on the lunar surface for a long time, what will they eat? Well, one group of researchers is trying to figure that out by growing food in lunar dirt. We'll talk about growing chickpeas in simulated moon dirt. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about Earth's ionosphere. And in the ionosphere, terrestrial and space weather meet. A research group is looking at how solar blasts from space and pressure changes from things on Earth like thunderstorms are causing disturbances high up there called gravity waves, and they can impact things like GPS satellites and radio communication. Matthew Zettergren is a professor of engineering physics at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University who is trying to better understand gravity waves. Matthew, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you.
We're going to talk about your research, and we've talked about terrestrial weather on the show. We've talked about space weather on the show. Your research kind of looks at where those weather systems intersect, and that happens in the ionosphere. Let's talk about what that place is first before we go deep into it. Explain what the ionosphere is.
The ionosphere is a layer of plasma, which is charged particles, that sort of surrounds the Earth, and it's produced by the interaction of the solar radiation with the upper part of the atmosphere. So the location of the ionosphere and altitude is generally between 100 and 300 kilometers. And so most people would consider that to be space, but it's really a region where you have a lot of energy and momentum coming in from the sun and Earth's magnetosphere and also from below.
And your research looks at gravity waves, not gravitational waves, which we've talked about on the show, which is something completely different. And I always like to call those gravity waves, but it's nice to know that there actually are gravity waves. tell me a bit about what they are and why you're so interested in them.
It turns out that they transport a lot of energy and momentum from the lower part of the atmosphere where all of the weather happens all the way into the space environment. And so this is something that's been understood better over the last 20 or so years, that these gravity waves that happen in the atmosphere are sort of what are transporting a significant amount of energy and momentum. I think of them as buoyancy waves. So if you have a medium like the Earth's atmosphere, which is sort of stratified into layers, then they have different pressure levels. If you take a volume of air and move it down or up, it has a tendency to oscillate back and forth. Gravity wants to pull it down and the buoyancy wants to support it. And so that's kind of the simplest possible way to think of it. So that sort of describes a stationary oscillation about some equilibrium point. But of course, anything that has a tendency to make a stationary oscillation can have wave-like action as well. So gravity waves are really, they exist in a stratified medium, meaning one that forms layers like the Earth's atmosphere, and they're just a consequence of gravity and pressure. So very, very much different than gravitational waves. They can be produced by things like upper atmospheric disturbances, like intense auroras. They can be produced by terrestrial weather. They can be produced by earthquakes and tsunamis. There's a lot of anything that moves the atmosphere up or down is going to have a tendency to produce these types of waves. And time scale does matter. These are usually sort of oscillations occurring on tens of minutes up to several hours. The gravity waves are sort of somewhat similar to surface waves on the lake or pond. So sort of waves in an ocean of air is how I've heard them described before. And I kind of like that description.
So you're telling me that these gravity waves can attack the ionosphere both from below, from things like thunderstorms or earthquakes, or from above, these highly energetic things that hit the upper atmosphere as well. And they're creating these oscillations in these different layers. What does that impact? Why is it so important to know what these are doing to that ionosphere?
So our project does focus on the gravity waves produced in the lower atmosphere. The importance of gravity waves and the importance of this research, one is that it's sort of a fundamental mode of energy transfer. You have things moving between these different systems and stuff that happens at the tropopause, you know, the upper boundary of our sort of lower atmosphere that contains our weather. Stuff happening there, it does matter. And part of the reason that it matters is because the gravity waves that are generated have a tendency to grow in amplitude as they propagate upward. And so you can end up with sort of a modest sort of thunderstorm system that displaces the air above it. And it can actually carry a significant amount of energy and momentum into the upper atmosphere. And that's why we know they're important. Predicting the details of how much energy and momentum is put into the ionosphere, how it affects the plasma there, and then how that affects technological systems is kind of another matter. So this is a Navy-funded project, and so there is, you know, an operational interest in some of the results that we'll produce as part of this project. And I think probably the most prominent reason people who run technological systems would be interested in this is that it affects radio propagation. So the ionosphere is all of these free charged particles floating around in sort of space as you would think it. And the idea is that if you have a radio wave, anything that's electromagnetic in nature is going to interact with radio waves in some way. And so you have these charged particles floating around and they react to the electromagnetic waves. This can be both good and bad from a technological perspective. Usually, like your GPS geolocation has to be corrected for ionospheric effects. You know, if there's an unexpected perturbation in the ionosphere, it can affect the accuracy of that. You can also get a complete disruption and loss of lock if you're producing like turbulence in the plasma, for example. Actually, it can actually diffract the waves and make it impossible to get a good result out of the geolocation. You know, if you know what the ionosphere is doing and it's not diffracting the radio wave, it's just bending it a little bit, you can actually correct for that. And I think that's, you know, a lot of the interest in studying the ionosphere with both using GPS and as a way to make GPS better. The other thing is the Navy and many other people are really interested in high frequency radio wave propagation. So these are pretty low frequencies, but they're really good for doing over the horizon communication because you can bounce it off the ionosphere. And so you can develop applications like over the horizon communication and over the horizon radar, except it's really sensitive to what's going on in the ionosphere. So if you put a gravity wave there, if you put a bunch of ripples in it, it can completely change the orientation of the radio waves, the direction of propagation and refraction.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Matt Zettergren, professor of engineering physics at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, about his research into gravity waves. How are you studying these things? You know, do you just wait for a thunderstorm and see what happens? Like, what's your research like?
I would qualify our understanding. So, you know, I can come up with an explanation as to how the waves are produced. You know, you displace the air, you generate the waves, they propagate up, they move the plasma around, they generate electrical currents. Like, this is all like the basic idea of how this happens is fairly well described. Predicting the specifics of that is basically impossible right now. You know, we can say there's going to be a wave here. We don't know what direction exactly it's going to propagate. We don't know if it's going to be filtered by background winds in the atmosphere. We don't know the manner in which it's going to interact with the ionosphere. It's going to move things up and down, but is it going to affect the stability of the ionosphere? Is it going to generate any type of electrical response or turbulence in the ionosphere? Is the wave itself going to become turbulent as it's going up into the ionosphere? These are all things that are not super well understood for a variety of reasons. So what we're trying to do is we're very much approaching this from the standpoint of we want to better understand the details of the fundamental physical processes. And the way that we do that is largely through computer simulation, but it does have to be very carefully guided by various data coming from various altitudes, right? We don't want to come up with a system of simulations and models that describes, you know, some magical Christmas land that doesn't exist in reality because we've failed to account for some detail that is apparent in the data. We're developing a set of numerical simulations to try to describe this. And so it sort of starts in the troposphere, the lowest part of the atmosphere, with weather modeling and weather simulations. We have models of the weather. We have models of the propagation of the gravity waves through the ionosphere. We have models of the ionosphere. We're working on kind of tying all of those things together into sort of a complete chain of physical reasoning. And right now, the chain is a little bit, you know, rusty and not linked together too well. That kind of is how I would describe the state of the field. But that model, being able to capture these gravity waves, capture the time scales, the spatial scales that are not normally captured by sort of global circulation models that folks use now, that is kind of one of the key components. And it requires some technical advances. We have an applied mathematics group that is helping us with numerical simulation, developing new methods for solving equations, developing new meshing techniques, you know, the gridding, so you can describe the distribution of different state parameters through the different altitudes efficiently. And they're also helping us with communicating from one type of model to another, like communicating from an atmospheric model that describes the waves to an ionospheric model that has you know, charged particles and electrical currents. So the data for the upper atmosphere is interesting. We kind of run the gamut from very good data coverage down in the troposphere, right? There's a lot of weather balloons. There's a lot of weather radars. There's a lot of data we can draw from to describe some of these sources. And when you get up into the ionosphere, there's almost nothing. I mean, you have satellites there making very local measurements. So the data validation and verification activities are super important to us and to the Navy. You don't know if you're right until you can accurately predict and describe something. We have people working on, there's a lot of imaging data now from the NASA AWE satellite, which has looked at the middle atmospheric, the waves in the middle atmosphere, so sort of below the ionosphere, but above the troposphere. Those imaging data also require similar types of processing to relate them to quantities in the model. They're imaging a hydroxyl emission, and it's a layer, and you know, you have lens functions and imaging through the layer, stuff like that to worry about. So we use a variety of imaging data, a variety of radio data as well.
Finally, Matt, with this research, how do you define success? You know, you're trying to create this model to figure out what the heck is going on there. What is a successful outcome of this?
Right now, when we take a weather system and try to simulate it and try to generate the gravity waves and follow the entire chain of processes, we run into a couple of problems. One of them is the source descriptions we use for the weather in the lower atmosphere do not appear to be sufficient in many cases. Sometimes they produce very good approximations to the gravity waves we see in the data when we run them through the model, and sometimes they're way off. And so a part of this success for us is understanding what is the missing link there? Why is it that this does such a good job sometimes and the models do such a terrible job other times? And I would say expand that to the entire scope of the project through the middle atmosphere and into the ionosphere. There are pieces of this process that are very difficult to predict, and it's because there's some details that we do not understand or something about the propagation environment or about the ionosphere environment that is not well specified. And so success for me is understanding how sensitive the system is to those unknown quantities. You know, what is it that this is most sensitive to, and how might one design an experiment to address that sensitivity or design a model study to address that sensitivity? If there's observations of waves, we want to be able to predict them routinely. We want to know what the uncertainties are. We want to know how they affect the propagation of radio waves through the ionospheric environment.
And make sure I don't get lost with my GPS.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Make sure you don't get lost with your GPS.
Simple stuff. Well, yes, simple stuff, but very complicated work that you are doing. Matt Zettergren is a professor of engineering physics at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.